From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the history of codes and code breaking from a code expert at the Department of Defense. Also, a Sacramento filmmaker and his new feature, a full-length film noir, and a review of a Hollywood movie set in a fictitious Sacramento TV newsroom. But first, the long-running battle over the state budget is over, at least for now. Governor Schwarzenegger signed it into law yesterday, along with hundreds of millions of dollars of cuts made with his line item veto. What was cut and what's next? Joining us with the latest is Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Marianne, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Why was Governor Schwarzenegger cutting money out of the budget?
Well, the governor says he had to make the extra cuts because lawmakers sent him a budget that was about $150 million in the red. As you probably remember, the assembly did not approve two of the key provisions of the budget deal that the governor and legislative leaders had brokered. That was the oil drilling off the coast of Santa Barbara County and then the plan to take gas tax money from local governments. Those were worth just over $1 billion. So the governor made the additional cuts, saying the state needed a reserve in case of emergency. So now the state has about a $500 million. Reserve.
Give us an example of some of the bigger cuts that he made.
Well, it was really a laundry list, Jeffrey, of health and human service programs, child welfare services, healthy families. That's the low-income health program for kids. It's going to mean some disenrollment, most likely, of children. AIDS prevention programs, programs for the elderly, parks. We could see up to 100 of them closed now. Administrative costs for Medi-Cal, domestic violence programs, and also the Williamson Act, which helps counties keep open space undeveloped. That was essentially eliminated. He left $1,000 in that program.
Did the governor say yesterday what he thought about these cuts that he felt he needed to make?
Yeah, in fact, one reporter asked the governor which line item veto was the toughest for him, and here's what he had to say.
The child welfare services, the healthy family, the Office of AIDS Prevention and Treatment, all of those are very, very tough decisions to make, and that's why I call them ugly. Not bad, but ugly. Those are ugly cuts, and I'm the only one that really is responsible for those cuts because the legislators left, and they didn't want to make those cuts.
When the governor says the legislators left, he's referring to the summer recess.
Correct. They are now on a break for a few weeks. They are set to come back August 17th. And there's a lot of unfinished business, too, I might add. The original budget package included more than $1 billion in cuts to prisons, but lawmakers never really allocated exactly what those cuts would be. In fact, an effort to do so almost tanked the entire budget package because it is so controversial. So we can expect them to deal with that when they get back in August.
Since the legislators are on recess, did you have a chance to hear from any of them, their reaction to the governor's line item vetoes?
Yes, even though they are in recess, the legislative leaders did send some statements out, some pretty scathing statements. Actually, the Democratic Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg, said almost immediately after the line item vetoes were taken, he said he would fight to restore every dollar of the additional health and human service cuts. And he's also questioning whether the vetoes are legal. He says the governor has the right to blue pencil an appropriation, but the funding levels in the budget revision in a lot of cases aren't new appropriations, they're cuts. And the Democratic Assembly Speaker Karen Bass has also asked the Legislative Council for a legal opinion on whether the governor's move is legal. So, Jeffrey, I don't think we've heard the last word on this by any means. I wouldn't be shocked if we see some more legislative action aimed at maybe reducing some of these in the future.
Perhaps you can't answer this question, but if the Democratic leaders aren't happy with the line item veto cuts, why did the legislature send the governor that was not balanced?
Well, that's certainly a question that a lot of us were wondering yesterday, because essentially they gave the governor, I mean, they knew that they were sending him a package that was about $1 billion shy of the original deal. So they knew that the governor was probably going to use his authority. And in fact, when the assembly sent him the budget that last Friday, he said, I'm going to make some more cuts. So that's a real good question. And like I said, I really expect we have not heard the last word on this from the legislature.
The governor made the line item vetoes in part to balance the budget, but also to beef up the reserve. Reserves are a good thing, of course, but I guess in a sense, the size of the reserve might be discretionary. Did the governor say why he wanted to make the reserve bigger?
Yes, and in fact, it's worth pointing out that this reserve is quite small as far as reserves go. It's just $500 million, but the governor did defend why the state needs to have a reserve at all. Here's what he said.
There's always the unknowns out there. And when we have our fires coming, because fire season now is all year round, so we have to have the money available to fight those fires very aggressively and have really a full team ready to go.
I'm talking about the state budget, its current incarnation, with Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Yesterday, Governor Schwarzenegger signed the budget into law, a budget revision, technically speaking, but also made hundreds of millions of dollars of cuts because the budget, as was sent to him, was out of balance, and also he thought it needed a bigger reserve. Marianne, you said earlier on that the Democratic leaders are questioning whether the governor had the legal right to make these line item vetoes, but where does that come from? Doesn't the governor have a right to make line item veto cuts in a budget?
He does. He has that blue pencil authority, and that's why things are a little bit murky. But typically, that refers to new appropriations that are in a budget. In this budget, we had mostly a whole lot of cuts. So that's where Democrats are saying, hey, we want to get a legal opinion on this just to see. Now, where that's going to go, we don't know at this point, but they're certainly making a lot of noise about it.
Let's talk a little bit about one part of the state budget that's being cut even further because of the governor's line item veto, and that's the state parks. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, actually, the director, Ruth Coleman, held a briefing for reporters yesterday. I guess they had had so many reporter calls, they said, we've got to hold a briefing. Originally, in the budget, parks were going to be taking a hit of around 50 park closures, they thought, is what it would end up being. And there are 279 parks total in the state. But then yesterday, the governor slashed an additional $6 million from parks. And Ruth Coleman said, you know, it's unclear exactly how many they'll have to close or which ones, but it could be up to 100. I guess they're planning to have a list after Labor Day. She says, you know, with parks, the biggest cost is staff. You know, they manage the people who use the parks, maintaining and cleaning up and so forth. So Coleman says layoffs are very likely.
And so in order to get the savings, you have to close that park. And then as you close it, you just lose those few number of staff. And so in order to get enough staff to get the savings, you actually have to close quite a lot of parks.
Marianne, one thing that stood out for me about this whole thing about the state parks is that, as I understand, their budget's been cut by $14 million, which is really chump change by the standards of the state of California, and yet that could lead to 100 parks being closed. That sounds to me like the parks are actually relatively cheap to run on a park-by-park basis.
Yeah, you know, that occurred to me yesterday too, Jeffrey. You know, in fact, one of the reporters said that's pixie dust in state budget terms. It is. It's the change under the sofa cushions in an $85 billion budget. But Coleman says they're hoping to find local governments, companies, nonprofits, anybody who might be interested in trying to save some of these parks. She says it isn't that expensive to run some of them. They're looking at maybe increasing fees, keeping some parks open only in certain seasons, or maybe just a few days of the week. So there's still a lot to be done as far as parks, and we really have no idea which parks or how many will close. In fact, Coleman also said yesterday, Jeffrey, that they have never closed a state park before. So if and when this does happen, that's a pretty big deal.
What about the famous IOUs that California has been using to pay vendors and some benefit recipients? Is the state still having to send out IOUs? And if it is, at what point will the budget give the controller the confidence to actually write, you know, things called checks?
Yeah, that's the big question. Maybe infamous is a better word for them. It's unclear at this point when they're going to stop. They are still going out now. I checked with the state controller's office yesterday. They had sent well over $1 billion in IOUs this month, and they will continue for the near future. Right now, what's happening is the finance director, the controller, and the treasurer are analyzing the budget to see exactly how much it helps California with its immediate cash crunch, because they not only need the savings over the whole fiscal year, but right now, how much cash can we get in the coffers. And then Wall Street will take a look and see whether it likes what it sees. Now, that's also unclear. The controller has expressed some concern about a few of the so-called gimmicks in the budget. For example, the deal shifts state worker payroll by one day next year so that the expense is shifted into the following fiscal year on the books. He's not sure how Wall Street will look at that. So why Wall Street is important too, Jeffrey, is the state has to borrow money every year to smooth out its cash flow. So in order for those IOUs to stop, California needs to be able to borrow some money. So at this point, we're looking at the near future IOUs continuing, but some movement on that probably in the next week or so.
As I understand, this coming fiscal year looks ugly, and billions of dollars of structural deficit are going to start rearing their ugly head quite soon. Does that mean there's going to be another budget revision at some point in this fiscal year?
That is what we all expect, yes. Even the governor said yesterday, as he was signing this $24 billion plan, you know, he said, we're not out of troubled waters yet, and that is true. The Department of Finance is estimating next fiscal year's budget shortfall at $7 to $8 billion now. But as you and I both know, those estimates have a way of growing, as we have seen in the past. And legislative leaders have also said they expect to be back perhaps in January talking about the budget again, although it could be sooner. It all depends on how the state's tax revenues come in, and a lot of analysts say California hasn't yet hit bottom. And there are a lot of risks in this budget. The finance director said yesterday there could be lawsuits as a result of this budget. In fact, there probably will be, and they don't know how those will turn out. So, you know, there are just a plethora of unknowns, and that is true in any year. But given the tax revenue situation, it makes everything that much more tenuous.
And finally, Marianne, do you know what lawmakers are going to take up when they return from their recess?
Well, the one thing we do expect them to tackle right away is the prison issue and actually allocating those $1.2 billion in prison cuts. You know, they've also talked a lot about finally tackling the state's water problems and looking at health care again or reforming the tax structure. In fact, a bipartisan commission is examining the tax structure right now. Their report is due out sometime in September. Those are the kinds of issues that lawmakers would certainly like to tackle. But if another huge budget shortfall rears its ugly head, you can be quite sure that will be front and center once again.
And if I'm not mistaken, those taxation proposals were supposed to come out in the spring and then the summer. So now it's been moved to the fall.
Yeah, that's my understanding. It's been pushed a few times. As I'm sure you can imagine, examining the state's tax structure is no easy task.
Yeah. Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Marianne, thanks as ever.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Defense Department mathematician on the history of codes and code breaking, in particular the famous Enigma code making machine used by Germany in World War II. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Listen to Insight at your convenience. Sign up for our podcast at capradio.org/insight. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, NPR's political junkie on the week's most intriguing political news, plus the ups and downs of working at home, not in the company office. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Humans have been making and breaking codes for thousands of years. This long history is the topic of a talk tonight at UC Davis. The speaker, David Perry, is very familiar with codes. He's a mathematician, specifically a cryptologic mathematician at the Department of Defense. His talk tonight will particularly focus on the famous Enigma code-making machine used by Germany in World War II. David Perry, welcome to Insight.
Hi.
How long have humans been making codes, do we know?
Wow. Well, it's definitely been over 2,000 years. We definitely have a lot of stories in ancient times of either cryptography or even steganography, just hiding messages rather than disguising them by manipulating them directly.
Do we have a first code? Do historians have a code that they point to and say, well, this is the first known code made by humans?
I don't think they do, but if they do, they probably are referring to Caesar ciphers, which are named after Julius Caesar. It's about the simplest thing you can do. You just take the letters of the alphabet, and to encrypt, you shift them over by a fixed amount. For example, A goes to D, B goes to E, and so forth. And to decrypt, you just do the reverse. So it's very basic and very simple, and Julius Caesar, I believe, wrote about it in his book on the Gallic Wars as a way to disguise messages.
Why did people start making codes? Was it for reasons related to war?
That's pretty much the first reason. Anyone who wants to keep secrets you know, can benefit from cryptography. And certainly militaries and governments would have been the oldest users of cryptography.
My guest is David Perry. He's a cryptologic mathematician at the Department of Defense. He's giving a public talk tonight at 6 at UC Davis about the history of codes and code breaking. The Caesar cipher that you talked about, where letters of the alphabet are shifted along so that they acquire a new meaning, are pretty easy to break, I guess, once you know what the idea is. When did codes become start to become as complicated as I guess they are nowadays?
Well, I'll definitely get into that in the talk tonight. The reason why the Caesar ciphers are so easy to break is that there's only so many ways to shift the alphabet, you know, less than 30. And so all you have to do is really try every possibility, and you will break the code. So almost immediately, they realized it was better to just scramble the alphabet, you know, not just slide it over. And there are there's an incredible number of ways you can make a scrambling of the alphabet. So suddenly it wasn't so easy to crack that code.
But then scrambling the alphabet also makes it harder for the person who's doing the coding to keep track.
It does. So when you scramble the alphabet, the key, you probably have to write it down rather than just memorize. And so you get into the problem of having to, if you change your key, you have to physically get a copy of the key to whoever you're writing to. And, you know, in ancient Rome, that, you know, was non-trivial to send messengers out to the field. The more complicated the system is, the more difficulties there are in making the system practical. And then in history, you'll see back and forth. Every crypto system that was come up with centuries ago, eventually there were vulnerabilities discovered, and the code makers would have to come up with something better to use after something got broken.
Is it harder, generally speaking, to come up with a new code that has a good chance of not being broken, or is it harder to break codes?
Well, that's a really great question. The whole game has somewhat changed in the last 50 years. And that story definitely starts in World War II. Codes nowadays are basically based on mathematics rather than being something linguistic. And so our ability to tell, you know, when codes are, what vulnerabilities codes have, it's definitely trickier than it might have been centuries ago. And the fact that we have computers now that allow us to, you know, attempt to break codes faster than humans can by hand, that has also changed the game. So it's a lot more complicated nowadays.
When you say codes are nowadays usually based on mathematics rather than some linguistic technique, mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, nowadays, communications are almost all electronic and digital, and we have to translate ordinary language and writing into zeros and ones when we store information in computers and when it's sent over the air, over wires. So the methods of encryption basically have to deal at the level of zeros and ones. Mathematical operations are performed in encrypting, and keys are numerically based. What I mean by that is it'd be probably too difficult to explain in just a brief amount of time, but it's certainly a topic that a lot of students learn nowadays. Elementary number theory is what underlies cryptology.
David Perry is a cryptologic mathematician at the Department of Defense. He's a codes expert, and he gives a talk tonight at UC Davis. It's a public talk about the history of codes. I guess back in the day, if you wanted to send a code to a spy that said, meet me at the railroad station at 6, it would just look like words of the same length, but the letters are scrambled. What do codes look like nowadays? If this mythological spy was to get a coded message nowadays, would it look the same, or do codes exist in a completely different format nowadays?
Yeah, I'd have to say that it's a new format. Nowadays, likely, if there were someone receiving an encrypted message, it would come onto their mobile device or over their computer, and they'd have to run some kind of program in order for them to recover the actual message. And they may never even see what the encrypted message looked like.
They'd have to run a program that's on their mobile device?
Likely, yes. Yes.
You work at the Department of Defense. Is there anything you can tell us about what you do at the department?
I can't really talk about specifics, but there are a lot of mathematicians, computer scientists, and engineers employed for the government working on both, you know, breaking codes and making our own communication secure. Certainly, cybersecurity is a huge topic nowadays in the news. How do we make our networks secure? There's definitely a lot of work, and it's a very rewarding job for me personally.
How long does it take to make a new code from scratch?
I teach a summer class in cryptology 3 weeks every summer, and we definitely have the students design their own crypto systems as a project because, you know, it's one thing to learn about, okay, this crypto system is vulnerable because of this reason, but it's a whole different thing to think about, okay, I know what the previous vulnerabilities of these systems are. Can I come up with something that addresses those? And, they're given a few hours to come up with ideas and a few hours to write presentations and present them to the class. And every year there are some really novel ideas.
The Enigma code-making machine used by Germany in World War II is a very famous story in the history of codes.
Yes.
How powerful was the Enigma machine, and why was it so powerful?
It was so powerful because it had been designed using all the principles that were known up to that point of what vulnerabilities existed. And there were so many keys to the Enigma that, you know, brute force was not an option. And so France and England and Poland were confronted with a very difficult problem. And it really is just an amazing story of how originally the Polish Cipher Bureau were able to crack the Enigma using mathematics in ways that had never really been done before. And later on, Bletchley Park, there are all the stories in England, and Alan Turing, who came up with other ways of breaking the Enigma, again, mathematically based. And the precursors to computers essentially were devoted to breaking codes.
When we call Enigma a code-making machine, mm-hmm. was it a rudimentary computer?
No, definitely not a computer. It was really a machine. It had a typewriter interface, and you pressed buttons, and when you pressed a button, letters would light up in a different place on the machine. And what was going on inside, it was electrical. The whole thing was electrical, battery-powered, and what you pressed and what lit up depended on where the wires were. And parts of the machine actually moved while you were encrypting, so how you were encrypting each letter changed every time you typed in a letter.
You said that the Allies had some success at cracking the Enigma code. Do we know how important that was towards the eventual success of the Allies in World War II?
Yes. I mean, I guess I've heard sort of the anecdotal stories that say it could possibly have shaved off 2 years from the war. Our ability to read Enigma messages. And there were times when they would make changes to the Enigma machines, and we were unable to read messages at other times. But mathematicians kept cracking at the new versions until they were solved. There are a lot of heroic stories of soldiers capturing Enigma machines when things had been changed. There are so many good stories. It's well worth looking up.
David Perry, cryptologic mathematician at the Department of Defense. Here at our radio station, we have to, you know, use passwords to boot up our computers, to log on to programs, and we have to mm-hmm. change them periodically. And you know, of course, that some people have post-it notes with their passwords on
yeah.
them. These are rudimentary codes. What about people like you at the Department of Defense? Do you have post-it notes with your passwords?
No, it's such a horrible practice. No, I don't believe people do that.
How do you create your own passwords and memorize them?
Well, I mean, it all depends on, you know, how important the information is that I'm protecting. You know, my personal email accounts, I don't try that hard to come up with something. The security isn't as important. But at work, you know, I'll definitely do all the good practices you hear about. You need to use special characters like punctuation, and you should use lowercase and uppercase, throw in some digits, things like that.
How effective are passwords, those kinds of regular passwords that people use, how effective are they?
Well, much like you say, it all depends on, you know, people usually get lazy with passwords. They'll write them down and then keep them very close to their computers, or they'll pick something that's really obvious, like the word password itself is I believe, a common choice, things like that. It's more about, I don't really know a lot about password security, I guess,
sure,
other than
I
what I read in the news.
Yes. David Perry, cryptologic mathematician at the Department of Defense. He gives a public talk tonight at 6 at UC Davis about the history of codes and code breaking. David Perry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Sacramento filmmaker and his new movie. It's a film noir called Night Beats. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight. Find our archives at capradio.org/insight. Tomorrow on Insight, would California be better off with a part-time legislature? We'll find out more about a campaign to get this issue on the ballot. We'll also check in with jazz musician Joe Gilman. He's one of the mentors at this year's Summer Jazz Colony for young musicians from around the nation at the Brubeck Institute in Stockton. Showing tonight at the Sacramento Film Festival is a new full-length feature made by a Sacramento movie maker. It's a film noir called Night Beats, and its writer, director, cinematographer, editor, and co-producer is Mike Carroll. He's in our studio. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us are two cast members. They are Bonnie Bennett, who's also a co-producer, and Laurie Foxworth, who plays the lead. Welcome.
Hi.
Both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike, tell us how you got the idea to make a contemporary film noir.
Well, it actually started. Our last feature film year played in the San Francisco Independent Film Festival, and when I looked at the rundown of all the films they had, they were mostly horror films and noirs and Quentin Tarantino kind of ripoffs, which made me really wonder what a film about a family of women was doing in the festival. So I thought I was having trouble getting that into festivals. So I thought maybe the next thing I should do is to do a noir. And because I think noirs tend to be more popular in film festivals. So that's one reason why I decided to try my hand at this one.
It's such a distinctive genre. It's been around for decades. How do you make a noir without falling into cliches?
Well, I think genres change from time to from period to period. And one thing that when you say noirs now, a lot of times people think it's going to be a gumshoe parody, you know, like of a Bogart film or something. Or it's going to be one of these Tarantino films that have a lot of shooting and a lot of profanity or something. I tried to go back to the core of the noirs I really liked from the late 40s, like Laura or City at Night, and look at the core of them, which is it's always set at night in an unknown city with people in society who generally fall into the cracks that you don't see stories about. And I tried to tell a story in a more classic way, in that I didn't want to have any gunshots. I didn't want to have any violence. And also, while there is some mature themes in it, there is not a single word of profanity. So I wanted to try to tell a story a bit more challenging.
Mike Carroll's new film is Night Beats, and it is indeed set at night. It's dark pretty much all the way through.
Yeah, I had to put some lights into it so that we could see what was going on.
And
so it was new.
And set in an unidentified city that often looks like either San Francisco or Sacramento.
Yes. Well, I shot all of the scenes with the actors in Sacramento, because we live here. But I shot all of the setup shots, exteriors, of San Francisco. And it's not saying anything against Sacramento, but that also kind of goes to my research about films, in that you want something that's really strong and visual. And I'm always dying to get into a European market. And I heard a review that the number one favorite city of people in other countries is San Francisco. So take advantage of what's just down the road.
Well, and both cities look great in the film. Let's listen to a clip from the film. This is from early on, where a reporter called Dubois
Yes.
Is speaking, and he's sitting in a diner, and he's looking at a young woman called Mercy.
Nightlife is all about routine. Find an all-night diner. Before long, you're a regular. Stick around long enough. Everybody knows everybody. Mercy was the complete nightbird. Every step forward she took, she was hiding her last. Lately, even talking had stopped. She'd just show up, going through the motions. Everything shutting down.
Laurie, you play Mercy. Who is Mercy?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. Mercy is a dancer.
Or stripper.
A stripper, absolutely. Drug addict on sort of a downward spiral who you sort of watch completely fall apart, you know.
What's it like playing a role like that?
It was actually really interesting. I really loved it because you sort of have sympathy for just people who live at night and go through...
Oh, someone's cell phone is going off.
Sorry about that. So it was really interesting, and I ended up being really sort of touched by the characters in the movie. They were fascinating and interesting and a lot of fun.
Now, your character, Mercy, is a stripper, and there are stripper scenes. Mm-hmm. And early on, there's a not a nude scene, but a semi-nude scene where you're doing pole dancing. Mm-hmm. Was that tough?
No, that was the easiest part. The hard part is falling apart and being emotional, but dancing is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So that was really enjoyable. I love that. As a 40-year-old, to suddenly get to do a strip scene is pretty interesting.
Laurie Foxworthy, she plays Mercy, the lead role in the new Sacramento film Night Beats. Your mother is Bonnie Bennett, who's with us. She was also in the film, co-producer, also happens to be married to Mike Carroll.
Yes, it's a very...
This is a family film.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Well, Bonnie, Mike, what was it like working with Laurie, a family member, on those stripper scenes? Bonnie?
It was actually very interesting. Laurie knew going in that she could do as little or as much as far as the stripper scenes as she wanted. Mike is very careful with his actors, especially with his daughter. As a mother, I can't say it was my dream to pay for my daughter's pole dancing lessons. That was not what I had in mind when I paid for her classical ballet lessons. So it was interesting. I'm very proud of the acting she did in this film. It's just remarkable. So I'm proud of her. And next time, I think maybe she should play some female in a religious set.
Laurie, you've never done a film before.
I've never done a film. I had done theater, and I was a theater major in college. But that's what I loved about doing Night Beats was that the way Mike filmed it was really much more of a theater piece than it was a film. You know, scenes were filmed from beginning to end. There wasn't a lot of stopping and starting and going over it. So as a theater actress, it was perfect.
We're talking about the new Sacramento-made film Night Beats. It shows tonight at 8 at the Crest Theater in the Sacramento Film Festival. The filmmaker Mike Carroll is with us, along with the lead actress Laurie Foxworthy and another actress and co-producer Bonnie Bennett. Bonnie, tell us about your character.
My character is a retired, I don't like the word aging, so I'll say retired lounge singer who is back in town taking care of a sick friend and just making some extra bucks, as she says, singing in a lounge. And this lounge singer meets a lot of interesting characters. One of them is Mercy, the stripper, my daughter. And it was really interesting to get to play, to act with and against my daughter, but we weren't mother-daughter. I had always envisioned us doing maybe Tennessee Williams, you know, Glass Menagerie. I didn't envision us doing a stripper lounge singer act, but it worked.
Let's listen to a clip of this lounge singer, retired lounge singer, mm-hmm. called Edie.
I'm a little lamb who's lost in the world. to one who'll watch.
Hey, can I get a glass of water?
Mike, could you tell us where the lounge scenes were shot? Because it's a place a lot of people in Sacramento are familiar with.
Well, we shot it at the Backdoor Lounge in Old Sacramento. I had I'd done a music video for the local band Cake a couple of years ago, and they wanted to do an improv concert. So in a place that where they wouldn't necessarily know who they were. So we went in and shot that just on the spur of the moment in the back door. And when I saw this place, I thought, my God, this is so timeless. It looks like a place that does not exist in contemporary times, maybe from decades or decades before that. And I just thought it would be a wonderful location. And when I was writing the script and decided to do this, I wrote it with that in mind, never dreaming we'd be able to do it. And was shocked that we were allowed to shoot in there.
What are the challenges of shooting a film at night?
Staying awake. And I say this not lightly, in that we started shooting almost exactly this time 2 years ago with Lori. Lori lives in New York, but she came here for 3 weeks, and we shot all of her scenes over 3 weeks. But because the days are so long, it wasn't dark enough to start shooting till 9:30 or maybe 10 o'clock at night. So we would shoot till 3 or 4 in the morning, and you might think, oh, that's a really hard haul to pull. The wonderful thing is that at beginning, you might have some traffic from people in clubs or bars or restaurants around where you are. But once you hit midnight, it's dead. And by 1 o'clock, you own the street. And there were times when we were shooting some things in a street where nobody would be around. And we literally would block off the street in essence and would take it over and shoot. And it was dead quiet. Once in a while, a police car might drive by. But they just pulled by to see what we were doing, and I think to see Mercy's costume, and then they kept going on. Nobody ever stopped us or asked what we were doing.
Laurie, could you tell us a bit more about what it's like working out in the streets in the dark shooting a film, dressed as a drug-addled stripper?
Yeah, using the restroom is a big challenge. Finding places that'll let you go in at 2 o'clock in the morning in fishnets and stilettos. Yeah, it's definitely a challenge, but that's one of the things that was so interesting about film, because you're not going to a theater, you know, you're really in the environment at night in a costume, dealing sometimes with people walking by or the public, and it's a really intimate, interesting setting.
Mike, as the writer, cinematographer, editor, director, and co-producer, you save costs, of course, on staffing.
Yeah.
If you had a big budget and you could afford to hire people, would you still do all those roles?
I don't think I'd be allowed to, but I would try to as much as possible. You know, if I was doing something that had a significant amount of money, certainly you have departments and you have to do things on a tighter amount of time. This thing took me 3 years, a year of writing, shooting over about 8 months, and then almost a year and a half of editing. You'd have more people, but my one reason I tell people it's good to know how to do all this stuff is that if you don't know how to do it and you have to hire somebody, they can tell you anything and you have to buy it. If you know how to do it yourself, nobody can walk all over you.
Night Beats, it shows tonight at the Crest Theater in the Sacramento Film Festival. Mike Carroll made the movie. He did most of the key aspects of it. Laurie Foxworthy It plays Mercy, the lead role. Bonnie Bennett is co-producer and plays another of the film's main characters, lounge singer called Edie. Mike, Bonnie, Laurie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a review of a Hollywood movie set in a fictitious Sacramento TV newsroom. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's a lot of cool stuff in our Facebook page, like the short video of our two storyteller guests last Thursday warming up and improvising before the show. I guarantee you'll enjoy it. Earlier in today's show, we talked about a movie by a Sacramento filmmaker. Now let's talk about a Hollywood movie that's set in Sacramento, specifically in a fictitious TV newsroom. The film is called The Ugly Truth. Joining me is film reviewer Gary Chu, who recently wrote about the film. Gary, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Good to be here.
Tell us about The Ugly Truth.
Well, I just kind of fell into seeing this film. I went to a screening last week and realized that it was set supposedly in Sacramento on a phony channel 2, I think. And as I was going in, I noticed that Stan Atkinson was literally walking ahead of me going into the film.
Sacramento TV legend.
Right. And I thought, well, I knew that it was going to be shot or supposedly in Sacramento from the publicity information. And so I thought, well, Stan must be going in to see it just because he's sort of knows what that road's all about, you know? And I've come to find out that he was going to see Harry Potter.
Yeah.
So anyway, the movie is about a local television station, Channel 2 in Sacramento, and they have this news program, and they're trying to make the ratings better. And so there's this guy who has this rude cable program on called The Ugly Truth, and they hire him, and he comes in and he starts doing all this reverse Dr. Phil stuff, like about lovelorn people, but he does it in a very titillating and sensationalistic kind of way, and always offends people in the process, and it brings the ratings up.
Who's in the film?
Let's see, Katherine Heigl, I think is her name. I'm not familiar with her. She's
a TV star. And mm-hmm,
yeah,
star.
That's right. Yeah. Katherine Heigl, and also Gerard Butler, who is from Scotland, I think. I looked him up. He's from Glasgow, I think.
That's right, although he speaks with an American accent in the film,
because mm-hmm,
he's
right.
Playing an American character.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think of the film? Did you enjoy it?
I did. It's a very light, breezy, sort of raunchy film that... I noticed the reason that made me think that the movie should do well is because everybody in the theater was laughing their heads off. I mean, particularly the women. The women really got a big kick out of it.
Did you enjoy it?
Did you laugh your head off?
I
normally don't go for these kinds of films, but I just wanted to see it because it was local. I mean, it had this thing, and you could see shots of Sacramento and everything in it. And I thought, well, I guess I'll go see it because I worked in TV a long time ago and had that. It was in that sort of thing, and so I thought I'd go see it, and I really wound up laughing myself silly all the way through it, just about.
My guest is Gary Chu, film reviewer, who recently wrote about the film The Ugly Truth, a big-budget Hollywood movie set in a fictitious Sacramento TV newsroom. As many of you might recall, Gary's also a former classical announcer at Capital Public Radio. You know, it's called a romantic comedy, but I looked up clips on the movie's website and mm-hmm. couldn't play them because they were too raunchy.
No.
So it's more like a raunchy comedy rather than a romantic comedy.
Well, it is, but it's got the structure of sort of the arc of a romantic comedy where you know that the couple that are in conflict will ultimately fall in love or have a relationship or something. You know that's going to happen, but that doesn't make any difference because what's going on before that is very funny. But it's funny to me because I can relate to it personally. And I think that's probably why I laughed at it so much. But it is quite raunchy, yes.
The film is set in Sacramento. Is it clearly set in Sacramento, or is that just a linguistic thing? They just say Sacramento a couple of times, but
no.
you don't get a sense of Sacramento.
They have aerial shots of the city. I think the aerial shots are the helicopter or the plane where they were was to the west of the Sacramento River, looking across the river and across the downtown skyline in toward the mountains, the Sierra Nevada mountains. And you get to see those several times, and there are some shots, and the interiors, I understand, were all shot in L.A., but everything other, I mean, there were exteriors of Sacramento. And people in the theater would go, yay, whenever you'd see Sacramento come up on the screen.
Yeah, and I saw a few clips. The city looks pretty good in the film.
Yeah.
Have you any idea why they chose to set the film in a Sacramento TV newsroom?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have no idea whatsoever. There was even an allusion, as I was talking to your former guest here on the show today, Mike Carroll, there's an allusion to a couple of people who are well-known in Sacramento on Channel 3, which made me think maybe that was what it was about, Dave and Lois Hart.
The married couple. Who
the
used
married
to
couple
be
in the film, yeah.
On
when I've talked
Channel 3.
To Mike Carolan, who works at Channel 3, and he said nobody knows anything about it. It was just it wasn't so, or something like this. Anyway, the review I wrote about it, I'm very apologetic to Dave and Lois about the fact that the two people in the film, one of them being played by Cheryl Hines of Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's quite funny, and it's a rather an adult film. Let's put it that way. It's an R-rated film.
Yes, there's an orgasm scene in a restaurant table, which is reminiscent of
Harry Met.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Come to think of it, I guess we can say that word on the radio, can't we? It's legitimate.
Well, it's a scientific word.
Yeah, that's good.
Gary, how did you come to be a film reviewer?
Well, actually, I started doing them on television back in the early 70s on a CBS affiliate in my hometown. And I did them for a while there. And then I started doing them on a classical radio, commercial radio station in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I'm from, and even sold the commercials that were on the reviews. And then I've done them a little bit right here on KXJZ.
Yeah.
In the very 90-second ones.
And don't your reviews also air on KVMR, the public radio station?
Yes, they do. They do intermittently. I had one last week. I had a 3-review one on KVMR, and I really enjoy. You know, other than classical music and jazz and folk music, my favorite thing is music. I mean, is movies.
And finally, Gary, it's been 2 years since you retired from KXPR, just down the corridor here, the classical mm-hmm. station. How's life as a retired person?
Getting used to it.
Takes 2 years?
Takes a couple. And yeah, I'm starting to pull out of it right now and enjoying is just doing sort of what I want to when I want to.
Yeah. And do you go back to Tulsa?
Some. I haven't so much lately with all the limitations being put on flying these days. But I go back occasionally to see friends and my mother in the area.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Great to see you, Jeff.
Gary Chu, film reviewer, who recently wrote about the film The Ugly Truth, a big-budget Hollywood movie set in a fictitious Sacramento TV newsroom. He's also a former classical announcer at Capital Public Radio. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Kelly Menemeyer, Linnea Edmeyer, and Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer was Christian Oldham. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Initiative to create a part-time legislature in California is gathering signatures. On the next Insight, we'll talk with some of the people behind the initiative and hear why they want it on the 2010 ballot. Also, local filmmakers in a contest to make 10-minute films in 10 days for the Sacramento Film Festival. And we'll check in with jazz musician Joe Gilman. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on Capital Public Radio.